Happy Bloomsday and welcome to the Outrider Podcast. We've got a six-part series. All six parts are being released today, so you'll be able to listen to them at your leisure whenever you choose. For this, I have a co-host, a friend of mine from graduate school, Delia Tramontina. She's from Flushing, New York, and of course she got her MFA at the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics there at Naropa University. Her work most recently has appeared in Newtown Literary, Forum, and 1111. Her chapbook, Constraint, is forthcoming from Dancing Girl Press, and in fact, it might already be out. And for 3.5 years, she co-hosted the online show Poet as Radio on San Francisco Community Radio. And of course, she lives and works there in San Francisco. Now, if you want to follow along with our reading schedule, we use the Vintage Classics edition of Ulysses. And, of course, it follows the page reference, or it has page references in the margins to the 1934 edition. And it was those page references that we used to break up the book. So we'll include the page range that we're reading from at the in the show notes for each chapter. But other than that, you're not going to hear from me again for the rest of this, except in my conversation with Delia, because, you know, that's how it works. So happy Bloomsday. And if you are following along, if you want to send us a message, by all means, please do. Jump over to my website, jquinnmalott.com, and send us a note. And if we get any comments, we'll follow up with an episode later this summer, or probably in the fall, answering questions, or also we've thought about discussing some later reactions that we might have had to the book after sitting with it for a while. So there you have it. Happy Bloomsday. Thanks for listening.
Why haven't either one of us read Ulysses yet?
I tried. I think what happened, if I remember correctly, I think I might have bought it when I was at Naropa or shortly after. I don't know why. It must have come up. And then I tried reading it. And I have memories of reading it in a cafe while waiting for my car to be fixed by Big O Tires. I definitely gave it a good try, and I got to it's folded down. I think it's something like 254. Uh-huh. I got to, and I don't know what happened there, but I gave up. I was at page 264. I gave up because I had no idea what was happening, and I was kind of holding on by my fingertips before then,
right?
So that did not bode well. And then like some time ago, my parents moved and I had to get rid of all of my books, and I brought back, so I got rid of most of my books, but I brought back that which I did not read yet. Mm-hmm. And that was one of them. And it has been sitting here in my bookshelf for, well, I don't know, since 2014 or something. Oh, wow. mocking me with its insolence. And, it's like this book where I said, I'll read it. But since then, since we've talked about it, and it's been very helpful to read about it, because I didn't read anything about it I didn't realize that part of it is in stream of consciousness and all this stuff, and that he's changing forms and stuff. And had I known that, I would have been able to enter in a much more educated way. But it's been helpful because I'm telling people that we're doing this. I was with my two friends last night, and my friend's mother, who just passed away, basically was nuts over Finnegan's Wake, uh-huh, which is like supposed to be even harder than this, but she used to read it for fun. She also has to reach someone in French. I don't know, but she read it. It was like her favorite book. But it's funny because my friend's an experimental poet, mm-hmm. and the mother would be like, "I don't understand what you're reading," but she's reading Finnegan's Wake, which is like probably which is much more challenging, I'm sure, than anything my friend is writing. So,
right.
But it's been interesting as I tell people I'm doing this to have their reactions and to kind of talk about their context for it.
Right. Yeah, I think my whole reason for avoiding it was, I am by nature a contrarian, and mm-hmm. I also tend to my contrarian nature comes out most when I'm confronted by people who annoy me, who tell me I should do things.
Yeah.
And for some reason, there have been a number of people in my past that really just were able to tap into that, you know, that contrarian streak in me. There's like, oh, you should read Ulysses. And my mind's like, fuck you. No, I'm not going to read it. You know, but
I mean, was it one particular person?
No, it's probably been a collection of people over the years, you know, it was people from when I was an undergrad and then people in graduate school and stuff like that. Just, you know, and cool. The same dynamics at work with, I just got done reading Ben Lerner's novel, Leaving the Atocha Station.
Oh, yeah, I liked it.
And, well, I'm finding myself kind of ambivalent about it because there's mm-hmm. this glowing blurb on the cover from Jonathan Franzen, who is just one of those people that, you know, grates on me. And anything he says, I just kind of automatically go, nope, I believe the exact opposite. In the back of my mind, I'm going, that's not best. That's not a good idea, Jason. That's not smart.
But you read it.
Atocha Station?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I just finished. Well, I have maybe about 6 pages left to go.
Yeah.
So I'm mostly done. I will consider it finished even if I never finish those 6 pages. But I like the writing. I just find myself being ambivalent about Lerner. I liked his little chat book, The Hatred of Poetry.
I have it, but I haven't read it yet.
And, you know, the writing's solid in Atocha Station. It's not anything that's annoying. I find it entertaining, but yeah, the blurbs are getting me. And so I think that's kind of been the same thing that kept me away from Joyce and Ulysses was all these people just gushing over it, you know, and oh, it's so brilliant and so great and you should read it. And how can you be a writer if you haven't read it? And I'm like going, yeah, then I'm never going to read it just because you said that.
Yeah. I'm sorry to screw up your total plan of being, you know, contrary.
Yeah, no, but that's, I'm trying to expand and grow and learn. And I finally decided that, you know, I probably should read it regardless, just so that, you know, if I do get to the end of it and I find that I am ambivalent about it or indifferent, then I could say, well, yeah, I've read it. I've read the whole thing and I talked about it. You should listen to the podcast. And I'm indifferent.
Are you like, do you think that this is going to make you more likely to dislike it as we're reading through it? Because
no.
I don't need you to be a weak link. You know what I'm saying? Like,
no.
All right.
I have a mission here. And, you know, part of the thing is that, well, when I was younger, and this was the thing at graduate school, I don't know if you ever caught on to it, but Gavin and I were both kind of in the same boat on this, is that we were both guilty of making pronouncements and declarations about things without actually having completely read the things we were making statements about.
I was not aware that
we were bullshitters. We were both extraordinary bullshitters.
Why? Was it because you were disgruntled?
Well, I think part of it was that we were insecure.
Oh, that's a nice thing
as,
to hear.
As writers and students, you know, and so, you know, we had to keep, I don't know, well, I can't speak specifically for Gavin, but
Gavin
for me,
might hear this and like,
yeah. But for me, it was just kind of, you know, making sure that people were kept at a distance.
Yeah.
And so they had that perception of me, and then, you know, then the fiction could just do its own thing off in the classes and whatever, and I would just be able to go home at the end of the day and not you know, feel like I'd said something stupid if I could just say something enough to keep that distance. And mm-hmm. so I'm trying to remedy that actually.
Well,
as I get
is,
older,
I, No, I do think there is a bias or the assumption that someone who is negative is really smart.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if you can just be critical and tear everything apart, it's like, wow, you must really know what you're talking about. So yeah. I think that's a valid method.
Well, valid in which sense?
Effective.
Oh, effective. Yeah. It's I don't know that it does much for your happiness in the universe.
No, but you know, I mean, I felt insecure the entire time I was at Naropa, and if I had to do it again, I would do it very differently. But I do, you know, everybody or me, I was comparing myself to other people, but who knows how many people were going around and doing something like that, right?
Right.
Which is, I'm putting up a good front, so I look whatever. I'm the exact opposite. I'm more like, I don't know anything.
I'm definitely excited and open to reading it, because, you know, as I get older, I would prefer to fill in some holes that are missing in my education that I refuse to cover because of stubbornness and immaturity and that type of stuff.
Yeah.
So
I will say there is a bit for me of like the whole like white male canon thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that there may be any number of people who are doing a piece like this that maybe are not recognized. There's that, like that, if I'm having any resistance, it's that. It's like, I haven't read a lot of the canon and I'm kind of like, oh, I don't need to do more of this white male stuff. There's that. And then there's also like, because he's doing this thing where he's using so many forms, whenever I see somebody doing that, I know I've been in workshops where people have attempted that, or I've attempted that, and mm-hmm. the people in there are like, what are you doing? It doesn't have cohesiveness or whatever.
Right.
And I always wonder, and it could be that, you know, I did it and they did it and they just weren't good at it. But I do, when I come across things like that, where people are just like, especially when they're shifting forms or shifting whatever, I do wonder like, what would this have looked like if it had been subject, you know, obviously his peer, we know, and I'm sure you know, because you did the publication history, people read it, people liked it, they wanted to publish it. But I do wonder, like, you know, if we were brought that to a Naropa workshop or whatever workshop we went to, who would have like eviscerated it?
Right.
And maybe I have something just as good as James Joyce, and it never saw the light of day because my spirit was crushed. I don't know, but I think about these things.
Right.
You know.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it'll be good to, you know, having had the education and the I guess the training that we've had, you know, because of the MFA and having studied creative writing, and that what we can pull from this, which rather broadly has been considered, you know, a bit of a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
And inventive and groundbreaking. And so what perhaps can we pull from this and learn and then apply to our own work?
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the biggest reason, I think, for me to finally read it and fill that gap in my education is, you know, how much of my own writing and ability to, because there's some structurally and thematically complex stuff that I want to write about, and I'm not getting any traction on them. And is it because I don't have this knowledge and other knowledge that, you know, either because of fear or my knee-jerk reaction to defy people I don't like,
mm-hmm.
have limited my my ability to grow as a writer? So that's a huge thing that I'd like to solve.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Have you read any other Joyce works before, like Portrait of an Artist or The Dubliners?
Nope.
Okay, neither have I. So who the fuck is this guy?
All right. So I will say that, like,
how's that for a segue?
So I have, I got stuff from Wikipedia, and then I probably lost. It's really bad because I have this person's autobiography that I'm using, and I think I threw away her name, but there was someone who, maybe I wrote it down, but there was someone else online who I found.
That's okay. If you can't find it right away, we'll just add it to the show notes.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know about the whole Bloomsday thing?
Yep. Yep. Okay, in fact, so we should have this all wrapped up before Bloomsday.
Someone was suggesting that we should tie that in somehow.
And his birthday is next Friday.
Oh.
February 2nd.
Okay, I didn't write it down. But anyway, so I will say that there was, you know, as I was going through this, there was stuff that, like, it brought in. So part of it that I feel like I got, like, a touch of but didn't really get a lot of information was the way he kind of affected by the First World War, mm-hmm. and the Second. Even though it's 41, I think there was fleeing going on. So there's that. And then there's also stuff around religion, mm-hmm. which is not very well fleshed out. He was raised Catholic, I believe, but there's all this, like, was he Catholic? Was he not? You know, there were things where he didn't want to participate, and I think his brother didn't want either. So none of that got very well fleshed out. But that stuff is kind of there. In terms of him, so he was, you know, he was with February 2nd, 1982, from January 13th, 1941, Irish. Was the eldest of 10 surviving siblings.
Oh, wow.
And apparently it's died of typhoid. So his father, I guess they did a lot of moving around as when he was a kid, because the father, I think was drinking a lot and mm-hmm. like either lost jobs or whatever. They filed for bankruptcy. They had to move it a bunch of times when he was a kid. And then apparently he was really big on St. Thomas Aquinas. He went to the University of Dublin College and studied English, French, and Italian.
Wow.
He wrote a bunch of articles there. He apparently tried to study medicine at one point. That didn't work out so well. He also had a singing background. Huh. And then there was a lot, and he had health issues. So right. apparently he had tons of eye surgeries. He also apparently had a phobia of dogs and a phobia of thunderstorms.
Huh.
It's weird, the things that they leave in and leave out. It's like, I don't know why he was fleeing to Zurich, but I know that he's afraid of dogs. And let me see, he tried to study medicine. That did not work out. His mother died in 1902. And the other piece that I feel like was not well fleshed out was some of his stuff, I didn't talk too much about this because you're going to, but that they wouldn't be published because of obscenity. Mm-hmm. And it did not piece out exactly what they thought was obscene. And Ulysses was not the only thing that was considered obscene. So he attempted to publish in 1904, Portrait of an Artist, as an essay dealing with aesthetics, but it was rejected. Mm-hmm. And then he revised the story into a novel called Stephen Hero, which was supposed to be a rendering of his youth, but that was not published. And then he rewrote Portrait of the Artist of a Young Man. But Stephen Hero was never published until after he was dead. He met his wife in 2004. So
1904.
Sorry. just doing that. So what comes up a lot, and this is probably something also you're going to touch on, is that a lot of the people in Ulysses are based on people that he knew. And apparently, somewhere in there, he was told about an infidelity mm-hmm. from his wife, but also hearing about running into someone else who talked about his girlfriend being unfaithful, which, of course, is one of the main premises of Ulysses. Yep. Did you get all this? Are you getting all these parallel things in your publication history?
We will have some echoes, but I don't really get into okay. too much of the other yeah. books that had some problems. There's some touch on there, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I won't get in, but basically a lot of the people in Ulysses are people who he knew, and incidences kind of mirrored that mm-hmm. too. And a ton of this is like where he was living in Europe. Like he went to Zurich, and it all had to do with he was in Austria-Hungary, part of which is today part of Italy. And then he was teaching in another part of Austria-Hungary, which is now part of Croatia. And then something happened with Austrians. There was an espionage ring. He went back to Trieste. So he spent spent time in Trieste and in Paris. They had two children, and he was in Rome, but he didn't like it. Apparently his daughter is said to have had schizophrenia.
Oh, wow.
And she was analyzed by Jung, who read Ulysses, and according to this said that Joyce was also schizophrenic. I don't know what we want to say about that. So 2007, he started having his eye problems. He was hospitalized for rheumatic fever. He returned to Dublin in 2009, and he was trying to get the Dubliners published. And he spent a month in Trieste again. Went back.
Having a little time warp problem.
He tried. Did I go back and forth? Because I have things with arrows and stuff. He also tried to open a cinema, which didn't work. That was in Ireland as well, and that fell apart. He went back to Trieste in 2010.
1910. That's the time warp we keep doing.
Sorry, God, I'm sorry. He returned to Dublin again briefly in 1912 during his year-long fight with Dublin publishers John Roberts over the publication of the Dubliners.
Mm-hmm. I talk a little bit about that.
He didn't get it. He didn't. 1910 to 1913, he was engaged in revising a portrait of the young artist. Mm-hmm. He was still trying to get the Dubliners published. The Dubliners were serialized in The Egoist, a literary journal. And then later that year, Dubliners was finally published as a novel by Grant Richards. And while other people were going off to fight World War One, he was still writing. And he drafted The Exiles, which is his only play, and then started writing Ulysses in 1915, he moved back to Zurich. His brother was placed in an Austrian detention center. He finished The Exiles in 2015. Kept getting eye operations, still working on Ulysses. And then 1923, he started Finnegan's Wake, which apparently came out in 1939. There was somewhere in here, there was a woman who published something. I forgot who, and there might be something where that you have in yours. It might have been Ulysses, where it probably is, and that's why. Oh, I don't have. That's why I crossed it out. I have Jason across here because I'm saying Jason's going to cover that. Don't talk about it.
That was probably Sylvia Beach and Shakespeare.
Yeah. Okay, good. So now we're getting into like 1920. He kept having eye. He had 9 operations on his eyes.
Wow.
He would travel frequently to Switzerland for the surgeries.
Did you ever find out what exactly the eye problem was?
No. Hmm. I did not look it up, but apparently.
Maybe we should actually read a Joyce biography, too.
Yeah. I didn't have time to read an entire biography.
And neither did I.
So this is when his daughter, Lucia, was analyzed by Jung, who said that after reading Ulysses, concluded that the father had schizophrenia. Joyce and Nora were officially married in 1931. His father passed away. Lucia's mental—I don't know if it's Lucia or Lucia. I'm thinking it's Lucia. Mental health deteriorated, and then he kept writing Finnegan's Wake. Yes, in the literary magazine. Yeah. Published various selections of Finnegan's Wake under a title Work in Progress. And then Joyce returned to Zurich in 1940, the Nazi occupation in France, right? So there was the First World War and the Second World War. In 2000, so to backtrack, in 1938, he finished Finnegan's Wake. And then it was after that they were trying to get it serialized. Nora, and so he died in 1941 after he had a surgery on a perforated ulcer and died. Ooh. And then Nora wanted to have him buried somewhere. He was buried in Zurich. Mm-hmm. And Nora died 10 years later. They were reburied together in 1966. His son died in 1976 and I think is also buried with them.
Oh, wow.
But I don't think it's Zurich. It might be that they moved them back to Because Nora tried to get him moved. Two Irish diplomats were in Switzerland at the time. Neither attended Joyce's funeral, and the Irish government later... the Irish government, she tried to get him back to Ireland, right, and they wouldn't take him. So there's a little bit of a thing on him and religion where, like, you know, was he Catholic? Was he not Catholic? Mm-hmm. Some people are saying that, like, Ulysses are very, in Finnegan's Wake, are very, like, Catholic expressions. I don't know why, but that's what some, like, people are supposed to know stuff are saying. And then there was a whole thing about, like, who he influenced.
Right.
So some of the names that, you know, point, like Salman Rushdie, the theorist Julia Kristeva, who I was reading her recently with a study group of mine, who characterizes Joyce's novel writing as polyphonic and a hallmark of postmodernity, aside poets like Mallarmé and Rimbaud, which is interesting because at the beginning they say he's part of the modernist movement, and then they are saying she's saying it's postmodern. So that is my
bio. Ramp.
Yeah. My bio that touched on everything a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I was going a little bit blind on all the times he moved. And then eventually I was like, maybe it's not that important that he was in Paris for 2 months before he went back to, like, because that was basically what it was. He was just moving all over Europe for a long time.
Yeah. Back, you know, with the modernist and hanging out with the Lost Generation, you know, and Hemingway and Fitzgerald and all the people that showed up for that. Ring Lardner, I think, was in on that group and all this other good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the lovely publication history, which I found a couple of things that were fascinating about that. So I think you had mentioned this in your bio that he began writing Ulysses around 1914 or so, and finished it sometime in 1921. While he was working on Ulysses, he was getting his story collection Dubliners published, as well as trying to get his first novel, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, which came out in 1916. Now, Ulysses wasn't the first time, as you'd mentioned, that Joyce had problems getting stuff published, either because of obscenity or stuff like that. In fact, his story collection, The Dubliners, was going to be published by a press in England. They bought it. They'd sent it off to the typesetter, and the typesetter refused to print one of the stories because they thought it was obscene.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I think it had some, I didn't find out what the exact, I don't, like I said, this is the first, I haven't read any Joyce. I forget what the name of the story was. But I assume it had either sex or defecation or something in it. Who knows? Because that's usually what Joyce got in trouble with. So Joyce made an agreement with the publisher that he would take the manuscript back and get it typeset and distributed himself. And so the day that he went to that he was supposed to show up at the printer's offices to claim his manuscript from the printer burned it.
Oh my God.
Fortunately, he had had a different version of the manuscript, a complete version of the manuscripts. And that's the one that, so it's technically it was saved that way. And around that time, he was also, when that was coming out, he was introduced to Ezra Pound by W.B. Yeats. And Pound fell in love with him, fell in love with his writing, and helped Joyce get his first novel, Portrait, serialized first in The Egoist. And then after some failures, helped him get it landed with a couple of British presses and then published in America by B.W. Hoopsch, I think was how they pronounced the last name. So that was all of the preamble. When he was well on his way to finishing Ulysses, but not complete, he began sending sections of it to Pound, who was getting it published in America in a journal called The Little Review. And then also there were, I think, 3.5 episodes that were published in The Egoist in Britain before they stopped publishing it. Now, The Little Review had gotten in trouble before for publishing other things that were deemed obscene and had been banned a couple of times already for previous sections of Ulysses. But it was the 13th episode of Ulysses that came out in the July or August 1920 issue that finally caused an actual legal problem and led to the 1921 trial, obscenity trial. And the editors of the little review, Margaret Caroline Anderson and Jane Heap were found guilty of obscenity. Now, of course, what happened in episode 13 was a character, I think it was Leopold Bloom, who will be our main character, masturbated in the scene. And so that was the...
masturbated, is that to say that he doesn't masturbate anymore?
Yeah, I don't know.
Just take a nap?
No, it's in there.
Oh, it's in there. Okay.
Right. So just, no, this, right. Just this section in that was published in the little review in 1920 was what triggered the obscenity trial. And so that was, so the little review was forced to stop publishing, their episodes, the serialization of Ulysses. And because of the rules of the Tariff Act and the Comstock Act, basically banned the book in the United States. In fact, the Comstock Act specifically made criminal any publications that were seen as obscene, and it also criminalized the mailing of contraceptives, abortifacients, sex toys, and personal letters that alluded to sexual content or information. So you can get in trouble with the Comstock Act for a whole lot of things. Now, of course, there's some speculation that it wasn't just the obscenity of, you know, the masturbation scene that led to the sudden prosecution of the Little Review and its editors at that time, because at the same time that this was going on in 1920 in the United States, we were having our first Red Scare, with America being totally, you know, frightened of, particularly, you know, the post-revolution Russia and the Soviets. There were a lot of immigrants who were coming into the country, you know, bringing a lot of scary ideas with them, like communism, socialism, anarchism, not to mention, you know, according to Americans, looser morals. And woo-hoo! And I'm sure that Ulysses and Joyce, being a foreigner and an Irishman living in you know, all over Europe, was seen as a threat. And so, of course, you know, had to punish somebody, and it looks like it was Ulysses. So starting in 1921, Ulysses was banned in the United States and would remain banned until 1934. Because of that ban, Ezra Pound got with Sylvia Beach, who was the owner of Shakespeare and Company.
Oh, yeah. And
got her to publish Ulysses. And they only published about 1,000, they only printed about 1,000 copies. And it was released on February 2nd, 1922, Joyce's birthday. And Beach has actually used the obscenity trial decision as a marketing tool. You know, read this book that was banned in the in America and stuff like this.
Which is smart.
Yep. And after that publication, Britain banned it. And they, of course, did it in a less dramatic fashion. There was no trial. There was just a decision handed out in a legal opinion by Sir Archibald Bodkin, who was the director of public prosecutions. And he was, you know, using the guidelines set aside in Britain's Obscene Publications Act. And he actually reached his decision to ban it after reading only the last chapter, saying that he was unable to appreciate how it was relevant to the rest of the book and was therefore convinced of its unmitigated filth and obscenity. Just from the last chapter. And that ban in England would last until 1936.
So wait, they banned it just because of the last chapter?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, in England, right. Now, the book was never actually banned in Joyce's home country of Ireland. But because of a fear of a ban and all the problems that would go along with it, Irish bookstores never imported it or officially sold it in Ireland until 1960.
Huh.
Yeah. So from 1922 to 1934 in America, Ulysses was treated as contraband, and copies that were confiscated were burned. And to get around that, you know, everything, there were lots and lots of pirated editions that were printed, you know, by various people and smuggled into the country and distributed that way. One of them was published in New York by a guy named Sam Roth, who was a notorious book pirater throughout the early 20th century. And his pirate edition was one of the more popular ones, and so Joyce actually succeeded in stopping that pirated edition, kind of self continuing the self-ban, but of course he wasn't getting paid because it was a pirated edition. But he got help with that from an international cadre of other writers that that engaged in a protest and got Roth to stop printing it. And then eventually, you know, Roth spent time in jail for pirating other works and things like that. But it was finally Random House that orchestrated an elaborate plan to break the ban. And they got help in 1933 from a lawyer named Morris Ernst, who was one of the co-founders of the American Civil Liberties Union. And Ernst had Random House order in a French edition of the novel with the sole intention of having it confiscated by customs.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, the plan, well, unfortunately, wrong word. The plan actually came really close to failing because overworked customs agents just let the book pass through. They didn't stop it or confiscate it. And also, it seems that the book was a common thing for passengers and people to bring in their luggage, not necessarily to distribute or whatever, because they'd picked it up in France or whatever. It was common for them to see it and let it pass anyway. So they probably was there was an underground thing going on with that book, because it had been, you know, praised by just about everybody who, you know, knew Joyce and was part of the, you know, that expatriate movement flowing back and forth between Paris and the U.S. So Ernst had to take the book from the Random House offices and carry it back down to the customs office and demand that they confiscate it.
Hmm.
And they did, and because of that that confiscation, because of that moment, that forced a trial. And of course, that case was brought before Judge John Woolsey, who, you know, read the book and eventually decided that there was nothing obscene about it, that this was, you know, somebody writing in a stream of consciousness and doing so with the intent to create art, and that he could not honestly create art if he self-edited out the sexual and biological functions. Yep, it's in our in the front there. So that was, and that in 1934 lifted the ban in the United States. Now, the ban would stay in effect in England until 1936, and I wasn't able to find a lot of information on that particular route. Like I said, I did, like you, most of my quick take was through Wikipedia and from an article by Adam Thirlwell in the New York Review of Books. His article was called "It's Still a Scandal" about Joyce and a recent biography that was written about him. So that's kind of the publication history of Ulysses and what we're heading up against here. In fact, you know, I was thinking after doing my research on that, you know, if I had known that rather fraught publication history, I probably would have tried to read it sooner.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, if somebody says it's a dangerous book, well, that overrides all those weird people that I just kind of knee-jerk, you know, defy for no reason.
I mean, back then were people like, hey, here's a dirty book, and then they're like, what's this? This is not dirty.
Right.
Dirty.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, you know, at the same time, you know, that this was going on, there was also, you know, the controversy around Lady Chatterley's Lover and stuff like that. Not exactly concurrent, but, you know, that was definitely more sexual than anything, I think, than what we're probably going to encounter here in Ulysses.
By the way, I found the other one. It was from the University of Oxford, and the name of the person is Cleo Hannaway, who did the other biography that I got information from.
Oh, okay, cool. We'll make sure, and I'll get that information from you, and we'll put that in the show notes just for.
Okay.
So we're gonna start reading Ulysses.
We are.
So just for the sake of any of our listeners, we have a plan. We've broken this up into, let's see, one, two, five, three, four, five sections, and we're going to be reading, what is it, they're not really scene numbers or paragraph numbers.
We're doing it by, well, yeah, and there's, apparently they're broken up into like 13 chapters or something, but it's not in the book.
Yep. No, it's, those chapters were the episodes were the episode titles when it was serialized, and those aren't included in the final novel manuscript. So we're actually kind of broken it down into our own little manageable chunks that we're hoping we'll be able to get through in 2 weeks at a time.
Yeah, so we're doing sections 1 to 153.
Correct, for the first one, and then 154 to 306 for the episode after that. And we'll remind people what we're doing if they choose to follow along.
I hope they follow along. That would be so nice.
Oh man, so I'm excited. This will be fun.
Yeah, I pretty much have like cleared, because I'm also reading for other stuff right now, but in terms of like actual stuff that I'm reading, I'm taking a class and I'm reading for that. But besides that, this is like, I've cleared away everything else I'm reading to just get through this, because I expect it's gonna be time consuming.
Yep. So, what do you think? Are you ready to start reading?
Like right now? Like to you?
No, I mean,
like,
just in general. I mean,
Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed. I understood all of that. We're fine.
Oh, it's a breeze. It's a breeze from there. Yeah.
You know what? I think we should make the sections bigger. Yes, I am ready. I am here. I have this book, which I bought, I don't know when, and I might write in it. I think one of the things, I just put these little tabs here because I put tabs on things when I'm reading them, but when I want to remember them later. But I am wondering how I'm going to get through this and be able to talk about it. And this might be a book. I remember that time, Jason, when I sat next to you in a class and you let me use your book because I had forgotten my book. And back then I used to write in my books. And I got confused, and out of habit, I wrote in your book. You looked at me. Do you remember this?
No.
I remember. Because
what was the book? Maybe I still have it around.
I don't remember. I have no idea what the book was, but I was like doing errors and stuff, and you looked at me like, for the love of God, woman. And I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? But this, I don't do that anymore, but I think for this book, I might have to actually write in it.
No, that's funny, because you know what? I write in books now. All the time.
Yeah, so I might have to do it for this one. This might be one that does not get... Well, no one's going to buy this thing. There's like 18 bajillion copies of Ulysses in every bookstore, so no one's going to buy this thing used. I might as well completely consecrate it.
Yep. And I've got my notebook for specifically for this to keep notes in, to augment my... My margin notes. So I think we're ready.
All right. I'm excited. And so we have to plan for 2 weeks from today. Are we going to do that, or we're going to wait and see if this completely kicks our ass first? Okay. So 2 weeks from today.
Yep.
Is February 3rd.
That is correct. No, that's 1 week from today. 2 weeks from today will be.
Oh, good. It's the 10th.
The 10th.
Okay. So.
Yep, but those dates won't matter to the listeners, so we'll figure that here in a second. And for right now, I'll just we'll say goodbye to the crowd.
Bye, crowd.
And we'll see you soon.